Thank you, Amy. So what is happening right now in the West Bank is not just Israel conducting what it dubs as Operation Iron Wall, a large-scale military invasion of the West Bank. But what we are seeing, in fact, is a green light of annexation. So what is happening right now in the West Bank is de facto annexation of lands. In the north, you have the Israeli army conducting its raids, displacing more than 40,000 Palestinians in the span of just 35 days. In the areas of Tul Karim, Jenin, Tubas as well. And what we're seeing in the center, areas like Ramallah, Jericho, and in the south, areas like Hebron and Beit Lahem, are armed settler attacks also trying to force Palestinians outside of their homes. So we're seeing a joint military armed settler attack that is happening in tandem and at once against Palestinians. And it is lethal. We've had at least 57 Palestinians killed in the last 35 days alone, 8 of whom are children. And this is not counting the injuries that are being sustained either from live ammunition or physical beatings and the mass arrests that are happening, including field interrogations by the Israeli army. So what we are seeing is an intensified campaign aimed at annexation of the West Bank.
As we talk about this, can you explain what is happening in Neir Shams, what's happening in Tul Karim, what's happening in Jenin, and the fact that Israel said they're going to stay for, what, a year at least?
That is correct. This is what the Israeli Minister of Defense is claiming, that in the coming year, the Israeli military will remain stationed in the refugee camps of Tul Karim, Neir Shams, which is also in the district of Tul Karim, and Jenin refugee camp. And now this comes after a massive depopulation campaign that really happened within the first 2 weeks of Operation Iron Wall, where they forced Palestinian families outside of their homes at gunpoint and then pursued to bomb or burn hundreds of homes in Tul Karim and in Jenin. So essentially, Israel was not just waging a war on the families. It was changing the landscape of Jenin refugee camp and Tul Karim. Now, within the third week of Operation Iron Wall, what we began witnessing and seeing was the Israeli army was putting up signs in Hebrew of renaming streets inside Jenin refugee camp. So this is signaling that Israel does not want to leave these areas. And you need to remember that Tul Karim, Jenin, Tubas, these are all border areas in the north. They are the only districts left between what is now Israel and what is left of the West Bank. So they're critical and significant geopolitically for Israel, especially in its attempt to annex the Jordan Valley. They're border states with the north of the Jordan Valley. And let's recall that Benjamin Netanyahu has been calling for the annexation of the Jordan Valley since 2020. So this is not new, even though we're also witnessing the use of tanks, the deployment of tanks. Again, this is not the first time in two decades that Israel uses tanks. It has actually been using them against Palestinian Bedouin communities in the last 10 years to force them out of their land. So what we're seeing is a formal and official and a public declaration of war on Palestinians, despite these tactics have been happening for the past 10 years.
Now, this is going on as this ceasefire deal, we'll see, is delayed or is being negotiated. The families of hostages, Israeli hostages and supporters, gathered in front of the Begin Gate in Tel Aviv Saturday, calling on Israel's government to reach a deal with Hamas that would see the return of all of the captives still in Gaza. This is Nahma Weinberg, who's cousin Itai Sversky was taken hostage and killed in Gaza.
We hear there is a proposal for completing phase two in a single move. The Americans want to bring everyone home at once, as does the majority of the Israeli public. The hostage families are demanding it. Yet, Israel's government is trying to drag us back into war against the will of the people and in stark opposition to the best interests of the nation. Netanyahu, who demanded the deal be executed in phases and not in a single move, is again dragging his feet and causing delays. He is trying to appease his extremist partners at the expense of the hostages
So that was Naama Weinberg, who is a relative of one of the hostages who died. She is blaming Netanyahu right now. They want to see the release of all those hostages. But can you explain what happened, Mariam? There was this deal, as has happened each time recently, that the Hamas would release prisoners, their hostages, and then Israel would. Israel was going to release more than 600, but they haven't.
That is correct. The Israeli regime is not adhering to the agreements of the ceasefire. Now, we need to recognize that according to Netanyahu's government, the reason they're delaying the release of the 600 Palestinian detainees is because under the pretext of what Netanyahu is claiming, he does not like the way the Qassam Brigade and Hamas is releasing the Israeli hostages. Now, you need to recognize that it's very well documented how Hamas is releasing the hostages. They're carrying out ceremonies upon their release. Now, if that seems to be the reason why Netanyahu does not want to release Palestinian detainees, we need to ask, would he prefer that Hamas release the hostages in the same fashion that the Israeli government is releasing Palestinian detainees? And that is with their heads shaved, that is with bruises on their faces, that is with skin disease, that is dumping bodies out of a truck into an open field. So we really need to recognize that tactically and strategically, the way the Israeli government is behaving is like an angry teenager. And yet the problem with that is that the repercussions and the consequences on entire populations is severe, and it's quite tragic. So again, it shows you the impunity, it shows you the emboldenment, and it shows you the lack of respect to either life or people's right to live freely and in dignity. And I think this is an emblematic moment of that.
I want to end with Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, speaking on about the ceasefire on CNN Sunday.
We have to get an extension of phase one, and so I'll be going into the region this week, probably Wednesday, to negotiate that. And we're hopeful that we have the proper time to begin phase two and finish it off and get more hostages released. I believe the prime minister is well motivated. He wants to see hostages released, that's for sure. He also wants to protect the state of Israel. And so he's got a red line, and he said what the red line is, and that is that Hamas cannot be involved in a governing body when this thing is resolved.
So, Mariam Barghouti, if you can finally comment on what he's saying as they move into part two of the ceasefire deal and what is happening. I mean, next week you have Egypt and Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other Jordan meeting in Egypt, the Arab League, to decide what they will support when it comes to Gaza. Your final thoughts?
Right. As we can hear him say, and we've heard this narrative again, the Palestinians are rendered invisible. Again, the focus is on Israeli security. The focus is on the hostages. No mention of the 14,000 plus Palestinians being held by Israel, thousands of them without trial or charge, making them captives in Israel. So again, what we're seeing is an attempt to ignore the Palestinian right for dignity and freedom and to ignore ongoing Israeli crimes against humanity for Palestinians. So it shows a similar trend of focusing on the colonial right and completely negating the basic human right to live in freedom and in dignity.
Well, we'll continue, of course, to cover this. Mariam Barghouti, Palestinian writer and journalist based in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Her recent piece for Navarra Media will link to its headline, Days into the Gaza Ceasefire, Israel Declared War on the West Bank. Up next, we go to Keith Lamar, death row prisoner in Ohio State Penitentiary. We'll speak to him live from death row. Stay with us.
In this country, most of us operate under the delusion that we live in the 21st century. And that somehow, without actually doing the work, we have overcome our history. It's not true. Instead of hanging people from trees, we use the so-called criminal justice system to perform legalized lynchings. And take this as a sign of progress. We confuse form with substance.
Okay, let's.
When I embarked on this
journey, The Drowned and the Save by Keith Lamar, written with Grammy Award-winning Afro-Latin musician Arturo Farrell, from the album Freedom First, with which Keith Lamar made with support from musicians led by Albert Marquez, a jazz pianist composer in Brooklyn. It's the first ever album created and released by someone on death row from solitary confinement. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with an incredible new animated short film. It's called The Injustice of Justice. It's illustrated by the world-renowned artist Molly Crabapple and is narrated and written by a man on Ohio's death row, Keith Lamar. Keith Lamar will join us live from death row in a moment. He's long maintained he was wrongfully convicted and is fighting his pending execution. The Injustice of Justice just won the grand prize for the best animated short film at the Golden State Film Festival. Keith Lamar made history by being the first ever death row prisoner to call in to speak at his own film premiere and to engage the audience. This is the full short film in which Lamar describes how he found himself sentenced to death after the 1993 Lucasville prison uprising at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility where he was being held. This is The Injustice of Justice.
My name is Keith Lamar. I'm a poet, author, and musician. For the past 31 years, I've been in solitary confinement, buried under the never-ending agony of sensory deprivation. On January the 13th, 2027, the state of Ohio intends to kill me. I'm innocent. Thousands of people around the country and the world have rallied around my cause, joining me in my demand for justice. Here's my story. When I was 19 years old and selling drugs, a group of would-be robbers in search of money forced their way into my apartment. A shootout ensued, and regrettably, I took someone's life and was myself shot twice in the legs. Facing a long prison sentence and on the advice of counsel, I pled guilty to murder and was sentenced to serve 18 years to life. Determined to redeem myself and make good on my potential, I completed my GED, enrolled in college, and became a voracious reader in an attempt to repair myself to society. I was in the fourth year of my sentence when, in 1993, a riot erupted inside the prison. Apparently, a group of Muslim prisoners on religious grounds refused to submit to mandatory tuberculosis testing and were given an ultimatum: take the test or else. Amid rumors of a forced inoculation, the Muslims took over the prison in protest, releasing some 400 prisoners from their cells and setting into motion an 11-day standoff that would ultimately claim the lives of one guard and nine prisoners. I was on the recreation yard when it all began. A guard came running out of the building with blood streaming down his face, followed by a masked prisoner who was carrying a weapon and yelling, "We taken over!" Against my better judgment, I went inside to check on my personal belongings. A fatal mistake. It was complete chaos. When I made it to my assigned location, I discovered that it was being used as a holding area for hostages, both guards and prisoners. I was thereafter approached by a masked prisoner who gave me the option to either participate or leave. I chose to leave. Hundreds of us gathered on the yard, waiting as the National Guard and Highway Patrol took up watch outside the perimeter fence. Later, when dead bodies were dumped into the yard, they stood by and did nothing. It was as if I was trapped inside a nightmare. Around 2 a.m. the following morning, we were rounded up and herded into the gymnasium, where we were stripped naked and then violently forced in random groups of 10 into cells meant for one person. Stressed and stretched to the limit, a fight broke out over food. Tragically, I stood back and watched as a man named Dennis Weaver was held down by three prisoners and choked to death. It was a cowardly thing to do, and I can now see and admit that. But at the time, I was worried about my own life. When I was later questioned by authorities, I claimed to have been asleep. It was my way of telling them that I didn't want to be involved. But it was too late. Because I had gone into the hostage area without wearing a mask, my name would be mentioned among a vast array of potential suspects. Even though the state concedes that I was never affiliated with any of the gangs said to have presided over the riot, the fact that I was already serving time for murder would play a big part in their decision to indict me. Ultimately, I was charged with 9 counts of aggravated murder. I couldn't believe it. Mind you, it was never expected that I would actually demand a trial. He copped out once, he'll cop out again, was the prevailing belief. In fact, no sooner than I was indicted, I was offered a deal. Plead guilty and we'll run the time concurrent with the time you're already serving. In other words, I would have gotten off easier had I actually killed someone. But why me? Why was I singled out for this undeserved retribution? It's a good question, one that I've spent the better part of 3 decades trying to explain. Here's what I can tell you. When the riot came to an end, overzealous officials rushed into the prison without first securing the massive crime scene, rendering inadmissible some 22,000 pieces of evidence. So there was absolutely no evidence to link anyone to crimes. This meant the state had to rely solely on the uncorroborated testimony of jailhouse informants, the most unreliable witnesses of all. What to do? Well, the first thing the state did was enlist the help and expertise of the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office. This was not a random selection. Hamilton County has the dubious distinction of convicting and executing more than half of all death row prisoners in the United States. And how have they been so successful? The answer is simple and deadly. Through the impaneling of all white juries, the use of paid jailhouse informants, and the intentional withholding of exculpatory evidence. I have now in my possession the statement of an actual perpetrator who admitted to murdering someone for whom I was sentenced to death. And this is only the tip of the iceberg. They withheld so much more. It's over 3 decades later now, and I'm still in solitary confinement, being tortured because I refused to plead guilty to something I didn't do. I'm innocent. Look. We kid ourselves when we speak of justice. Until we have a process that holds everyone equally accountable for their actions, this system will remain what it has always been, a punishment system. And as we all know, those who don't have the capital get the punishment.
That's the new award-winning short film, The Injustice of Justice. Illustrated by the world-renowned artist Molly Crabapple, narrated and written by Keith Lamar, who's fighting to raise awareness about his case and death row. He faces execution January of 2027. The film, The Injustice of Justice, just won the grand prize for the best animated short film at the Golden State Film Festival. Keith Lamar has been held in prison for 36 years, 32 years in solitary confinement, 30 years on death row. His self-published memoir is Condemned, the whole story. He's joining us now live from death row at Ohio State Penitentiary. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Keith Lamar.
How are you? It's such an honor and pleasure. I can tell you, I'm not just speaking for myself, but for so many people who are inside. We have listened to you for decades, and so it's quite an honor, quite an honor. Thanks so much.
Can you talk about the making of this film, explaining your case, and what you're hoping to accomplish right now. You have made this film. You do live concerts that are performed around the world, remarkably, where you're joining from death row. You have book clubs where your own book is read, but where you also lead in discussion of other books as well with high schools and other places. Talk about your message, Keith.
Well, I you know, from the very beginning, just wanted to stand on my innocence. You know, it was never really a matter of me not wanting to speak out, to stand up for myself. But that was the whole point of me demanding the trial. But the whole system, I soon found out, is centered around obedience, around operating within prescribed parameters and whatnot. And I was advised to remain quiet during my trial and thereafter, and I did. You know, I went along with it. You know, that's what we do. And, you know, other smarter, more learned people would speak on my behalf, would stand up and fight for my life, you know, and I believe that. And I just kept going deeper and deeper into the darkness until I found myself in this really, really desperate place where I was really standing on the brink of my existence. You know, I had to find out the hard way that in order for my life to be mine, that I had to stand up and claim it. You know, so that was really the thing that was the catalyst that pushed me to start speaking up and reaching to utilize my own agency. And all of these things that you just mentioned is a product of that general thrust, you know, that thing that just coming to the conclusion that if I don't stand up right now, then I might lose my life. And so that was the thing that kind of started the movie. You know, I first started, I wrote the book that you mentioned, Condemned, and that was over 200 pages. And not long after that, a dear friend of mine, Lloyd Swain, and produced a documentary, which was 30 minutes. And so we was trying to figure out a way to condense it even more because, you know, of course, people have short attention spans. We understand, I understand that people have their own problems, have their own lives to live. And so, you know, it's asking a lot to ask someone to sit down and read a 200-some page book or 30-minute documentary. But we thought that if we condense the story into a 7-minute short, then possibly that could garner more attention. So that was the whole impetus behind creating the movie. You know, my friend, my campaign manager, Amy Goodale, was at the museum, Bryan Stevenson Museum in Alabama, and saw a movie that Molly Crabapple had produced. And she had the idea from that maybe this could be applied to my story and we can, you know, put forth a similar project. And we contacted Molly and her team. And, you know, was able to raise the funding through this really kind individual named David Rouse. And, you know, next thing, you know, we had a movie on our hands. And so, yeah, I'm really, really grateful for the whole process, for sure.
Keith Lamar, in your book, Condemned, about Bobby Sands, if you can explain who he is, his hunger strike, and how it inspired you to go on a hunger strike, which led to your case being known. I mean, you've been written about in the New York Times. You have jazz greats playing with you, supporting your cause.
Yeah. One of my friends who I think you might know named Stoughton Lynn was a famous historian, social activist. He, in the beginning, when I was first sentenced to death row, he somehow found his way into my life. And he sent me that book by Bobby Sands, Nothing But an Unfinished Song, written by Dennis O'Hearn, who has since become a very close friend of mine. He sent me that book. And as I was reading it, it felt as if I was being sent a message. If I had been pleading with these people, it was going on 18 years in a civil suit with 8 years, all to no avail. And, you know, I was reading this book, and it was almost a last-ditch effort before I was about to give up. And Bobby Sands and his comrade, Bobby Sands, for those who don't know, was an Irish prisoner who, along with several of his comrades, went on a hunger strike in Ireland. And, you know, some of their demands were very basic, just to be treated as human beings, which, of course, resonated with me. And
Not long after I finished that book, I reached out to the author, Dennis O'Hearn. I wrote him. We struck up a correspondence. He came to see me. We became really close friends. And I decided to undergo a hunger, enact a hunger strike myself, along with several other prisoners here at the Supermax, went on hunger strike. And after 18 years of not being able to break through court cases and all that, in 12 days of being on a hunger strike, I was sitting in the visiting room with my family. And that was like a seminal moment in my journey. It kind of taught me that if anything is going to change, you have to stand up and speak out, you know, on your own. And, you know, one of my literary heroes, Richard Wright, he wrote in his book, Black Boy, that if you speak out who you are, you would discover that you are not alone.
Keith,
you know, being in solitary confinement, like,
I wanted to bring in your lawyer, Keegan Stefan. In one of Trump's first executive orders, January 20th, was to restore the death penalty, Trump said, which includes the order that the attorney general ensures all states have necessary drugs. This is Keith's second execution date. What is it? January 13th, 2027. If you can explain what happens right now in court, where the case stands in court, and the role of the Ohio governor, Mike DeWine, the position he has taken, since he, not Trump, would decide what happens ultimately to Keith Lamar.
Yes. Hi, Amy, and thanks for elevating Keith's case. You know, Keith, unfortunately, exhausted his direct appeals long ago. The state courts and federal courts looked at his trial and determined incorrectly, that there were no constitutional deficiencies and upheld his conviction and his death sentence. I do think that any fair-minded jurist looking at his trial now would deem it unconstitutional and overturn his convictions. Unfortunately, the only way back into court is to find newly discovered evidence. So me and a team of attorneys have been reviewing all the records in his case and talking to witnesses for the last 2 years, trying to turn up newly discovered evidence. We have discovered a lot of new evidence supporting Keith's innocence. You know, I started as a skeptic. I'm a prison abolitionist, definitely an abolitionist of the death penalty. It doesn't matter to me if he's guilty, he shouldn't be put to death. But I can tell you after looking at the record, talking to witnesses, there is no doubt in my mind that he is actually innocent. And we are working to put together a motion based on the new evidence to get back into court so that we can prove his innocence before his execution date. Unfortunately, you know, there is very little justice in the justice system, as Keith has noted. So it's going to take much more than just litigation. We need a mass movements of people, you know, speaking out, acting out, and pushing the governor to pause his execution once again litigate.
Let me give the last word to Keith Lamar. Keith, you're scheduled to die January 13th, 2027, second execution date. First was for lack of drugs to inject into you. Your final message is, May 31st, they're expected to have a concert at Joe's Pub here. It's your 56th birthday then.
Yes, that's right. You know, I've been living under the threat of death, as you noted, at the outset for over 3 decades. So it's not dying. You know, I've already made peace with the fact that I'm going to die at some point and someday. All of us are. But the thing that really drives me is I'm here. How can I live? You know, you reference all the things that I've accomplished since being on death row, and all those things come from a desire just to live because I'm alive. You know, I had these really amazing musicians come into my life, Albert Marquez, Arturo Ferro, Caroline Davis, Elsa Nielsen, you know, some
more. Keith, we're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue the conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. Keith Lamar, artist, teacher, writer, death row prisoner, speaking to us from the Ohio State Penitentiary in Youngstown. I'm Amy Goodman.
My name's Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of 2 young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do 3 key things. Pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators. Transition all existing programs to $10 a day. And plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to tenaday.ca to learn more.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.